At Contra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Today we are wrestling with a concept that we all sort of take for granted, something that's both deeply personal and legally fundamental.
The family.
The family, exactly. And we're using the work of legal expert Jonathan Herring, a really preeminent scholar in family law, to dismantle the myth of the traditional family.
And maybe build a smarter, more inclusive definition in its place.
This feels like one of the most relevant deep dives we could possibly do right now.
Oh, absolutely. Because social norms and, you know, relationship structures have just changed so dramatically in the last 50 years.
But our legal systems, our social recognition, they just haven't kept pace.
Not even close. And when the law defines a family too narrowly, it doesn't just feel unfair. It causes, I mean, immense material hardship and legal risk.
Yeah.
Right. Think about inheritance or tax benefits or just the basic right to visit someone you love in the hospital. The old rigid definitions are failing millions of people.
People living in these non-traditional but, you know, deeply committed family lives.
So I think our mission here is simple but also pretty profound.
Yeah, to shift our collective understanding of family away from these outdated structure-based definitions, what we're going to call form.
And move toward a functional understanding.
Mm-hmm. Prioritizing what families actually do, the commitment, the care, the shared life, the support.
So it's a move from rigid checklists to, well, a living, breathing reality.
I like that. A living reality.
Okay, so let's unpack the mind behind this critique. Our main guide here is Jonathan Herring. He's a professor of law at the University of Oxford.
And his influence, it really can't be overstated. His textbooks on family law, medical law, criminal law, they're basically standard issue in universities all over the English-speaking world.
So what makes his perspective so distinctive? He's not just a philosopher commenting from the sidelines.
What?
Not at all. He's a legal expert who has spent his entire career grappling with the concrete, you know, high-stakes consequences of these definitions in actual courtrooms.
He's dealing with human life at its most vulnerable.
Exactly. Custody battles, domestic violence cases, disputes over medical authority. He's the person who understands what happens when a legal loophole excludes a loving, committed relationship.
So he brings this scholarly rigor to what is often a very emotionally charged debate.
He does. His work is this practical challenge to our traditional assumptions. He shows that defining family isn't just an academic exercise.
It's a direct determinant of rights and social justice.
He's essentially providing the legal and ethical framework for why we must evolve. He uses all the complexities of modern lifelike surrogacy or same-sex marriage, not as outliers, but as proof that the foundational rules are just, well, inadequate.
So let's get into the book's central premise. Mm. If we had to boil his core argument down, what is it?
The premise is that the family is not some timeless, natural, or universal category. It just isn't.
It's a fluid concept.
Entirely socially constructed. The legal and social definitions we use, they just reflect the values and biases of a particular time and culture, not some inevitable biological blueprint.
And he starts by immediately attacking that idealized notion of the traditional nuclear family.
Oh, yeah. The one you see in old sitcoms, right? The married heterosexual couple with their biological kids.
He reveals it as a relatively recent and culturally specific phenomenon. It might have been dominant for a short time in Western history, maybe post-World War II, but it is not the historical norm for humanity.
Exactly. And by dismantling that myth, he opens up the space to ask a much better question. What is the family for?
Right. What does it do?
He explores all its functions, emotional security, economic interdependence, and yes, reproduction. But he also forces us to confront the conflicting roles of, say, love versus genetics.
And the really uncomfortable dark side of oppression and abuse that so often lurks just beneath the surface of family privacy.
The major problem he identifies is this institutional rigidity of the state. It continues to use these nostalgic, brief historical definitions in the face of constantly evolving human relationships.
People change, technology changes, society changes.
But the tax code and the inheritance laws lag decades behind.
And this brings us right to the foundational tension he explores, the one that really governs almost all modern family law.
Form versus function.
Let's nail down that distinction because it is everything. Formalist definitions rely exclusively on structure.
Right. Marriage certificates, blood ties, adoption paperwork. It's just a binary checklist.
If the form isn't right, you're out.
And that is inherently exclusionary. I mean, think about two elderly sisters who've lived together for 50 years. They rely entirely on each other for financial, emotional, physical care.
They are a functional family unit.
Completely, but formally. They're just roommates. So if one sister has a medical crisis, the other is legally barred from making life-saving decisions.
All right, it's automatically granted to a spouse who might have been estranged for decades.
Exactly. That example just perfectly illustrates the cruelty of relying only on form.
So, by contrast, the functionalist definition, it focuses on what a family does.
It's the group that provides mutual care, emotional support, financial interdependence, nurturing.
Functionalism recognizes that, you know, chosen families or long-term cohabiting partners or non-biological caregivers.
Yeah.
They are all performing the necessary duties of a family.
Right, regardless of their legal status. And this is massively inclusive, particularly for the LGBTQ plus community, where legal recognition was denied for so long.
But let's play devil's advocate for a second, because this is a real-world legal challenge. If function is the measure, how does a court prove mutual care?
That's the tricky part.
It seems like it could require this massive, invasive, and potentially very subjective investigation. And legal systems, they crave clarity.
And Herring absolutely acknowledges that. Functionalism introduces subjectivity, and that is its greatest weakness from a purely bureaucratic standpoint. But he counters that the injustice and exclusion caused by rigid formalism is a far, far greater social harm. He suggests that while we might need some legal thresholds,
like maybe proof of financial pooling or how long they've lived together,
something like that, yes. But the legal system has to prioritize seeking the reality of the relationship over the perfection of the paperwork.
So in essence, the conclusion is that the act of defining family is fundamentally political and ethical.
It determines who gets access to state support, who is protected by law, and who is recognized as having legitimate emotional and financial claims. It's huge.
Shifting gears a little, this leads us to that explosive tension between biology and social bonds. The whole blood is thicker than water idea.
Yeah, Herring dedicates a lot of attention to the powerful pull of genetics, which is, I think, often mistakenly conflated with true commitment and capability.
And this complexity just explodes with modern reproductive technologies.
IVF, and especially third-party reproduction like surrogacy, it forces the law to confront these scenarios where three or more people might have biological or gestational links to a single child.
So think of the question of parentage in a surrogacy arrangement. Who is the real mother?
Is it the genetic mother who provided the egg? Is it the gestational mother who carried the child for 9 months? Or is it the social mother who commissioned the surrogacy and plans to raise the child?
The law is forced to weigh form, the genetics and gestation against function, the planned commitment to care.
And Herring argues that the law, thankfully, is moving, though sometimes very slowly, toward giving far more weight to the social and psychological reality of parenting.
So the consistent act of caring for and raising a child, the function, is rightly outweighing the simple biological link.
And adoption is really the legal blueprint for this functional view. In an adoption, the law deliberately severs the biological tie to create a superior legal bond based entirely on the nurturing relationship and commitment.
A child's success depends far more on things like stability, resources, and emotional support than on the specific configuration or blood relation of the adults providing the care.
Exactly.
Now, we have to shift gears again to a very necessary and sobering chapter in Herring's work, the dark side of the family.
We've been discussing the family as a source of support, but Herring reminds us that this same private sphere is also the most common site of profound danger.
Abuse, oppression, domestic violence, child neglect, financial abuse of the elderly.
And this acknowledgement is so crucial because the intense idealization of the family as this perfect, private, unquestionable haven shielded by privacy laws,
it allows this dark side to fester in silence.
Yes, the romanticized view of family actively prevents society from seeing and addressing harm where it is most concentrated.
And that's precisely why the state, you know, despite its imperfections, has a necessary, if often controversial, role to play.
The state has a fundamental duty to protect vulnerable citizens, especially children and victims of domestic abuse, even if it means intervening in what the parties call private family matters.
Child protection law is the clearest example. It's that complex, difficult line where public duty clashes with private autonomy.
And Herring demonstrates that this intervention isn't just bureaucratic interference. It's a necessary function of a society committed to justice. It requires the state to balance the family's right to privacy with the child's right to safety.
That's a powerful point. We've covered the major analytical tensions, but let's maybe synthesize these into the core takeaways Herring wants us to internalize.
Okay. Theme one, which is really the cornerstone, function over form.
The superiority of defining family based on committed action caring, supporting, loving, rather than structural requirements like marriage or blood ties.
Right. And the reflection here is that we should consciously prioritize the functional health and the commitment level in our own care networks, you know, regardless of what their formal titles are.
Theme two, the constructed nature of family norms.
The models we all feel compelled to conform to are just choices. They're shaped by history, economics, and legal codes, not some biological destiny.
And that's incredibly liberating, isn't it? It opens up space to define your own family structure without feeling guilty that you're deviating from some divine standard.
It really is. Theme three, the redefinition of parenthood. The act of nurturing and raising a child, what he calls social parenthood. That's the defining feature of parental function.
And the law must increasingly recognize that stability and love trump simple biological links.
And finally, theme four, family recognition as economic justice.
Because these narrow definitions are not benign, they create real material hardship.
Denying basic rights like tax relief, benefits, survivor pensions to alternative arrangements, that is a failure of economic and social justice. Inclusive policies are just necessary to support the care networks that actually exist.
Herring's work is packed with this kind of synthesized wisdom, pushing against these really deeply held cultural assumptions.
Let's maybe highlight some of his most potent ideas that really stay with you.
I love the clear distinction he draws on commitment, the idea that a family is not defined by the accident of biology, but by the intention of care.
That elevates commitment, a choice over mere genetics. It's powerful.
And then there's the necessary realism about danger. To idealize the family as a perfect private haven of love is not only naive, but dangerous.
He argues that romanticism is an obstacle to protecting victims. You can't help if you refuse to see the problem.
His critique of the legal system is also so sharp, he says. Our legal frameworks reflect not the reality of family life, but the mythology of a family life that existed for barely a generation.
It's such a powerful reminder that our legal assumptions are based on this fleeting nostalgia, not on genuine human diversity.
And finally, the child-focused conclusion. Children thrive not because of who their parents are, but because of how their parents love them.
Stability and emotional support, those are the core variables that define positive outcomes. The specific adult structure is secondary.
This whole analysis has such profound real-life applications. On a personal level, it encourages all of us to move beyond judgmental views of, say, blended families, or single-parent families, or chosen families.
It prompts you to value and support your true care networks, the people who perform the function, regardless of their title.
And professionally, I mean, especially for lawyers, social workers, medical personnel, the book provides the precise language to advocate for clients in non-traditional arrangements.
For instance, fighting for medical decision-making authority for a long-term cohabiting partner who is, under current law, legally invisible.
And civically, it just transforms how you engage with policy when you evaluate debates on marriage equality, parental leave, or elder care policies.
You now understand that the core argument isn't about upholding tradition. It's about defining the societal values and support systems that prioritize functional, committed care.
So what's your core takeaway from all this?
For me, it's the paradigm shift Herring compels us to accept, that family is a verb, not just a noun.
I like that.
It's defined by the ongoing actions of loving, caring, supporting, and protecting. The goal of law and society should be to recognize and support these essential functional networks wherever we find them.
What I appreciate most about the book is its honest complexity. By acknowledging the family's potential for harm and the difficulty of legal definition, Herring doesn't diminish its importance.
No, not at all.
He actually allows us to create a more honest, more robust, and more supportive legal and social structure that serves the actual messy, diverse needs of modern people.
It's a powerful argument for recognition and justice, one that's rooted in the reality of human relationships, not in some outdated mythology.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.